think I started in 2002 and finished in 2006. I started studying commerce information systems. I really like programming and playing with computers, which is kind of half of the information systems course. I'd never really done much of it before that. But I didn't like kind of all the management-y stuff. And that sort of made it pretty clear to me that engineering was probably a better fit for me than information systems. And so actually, I hadn't liked it at high school, but really came to like sort of maths and physics and programming and all that sort of stuff. So I changed out of commerce information systems to do commerce. Gosh, I think I did mechanical engineering, then electrical engineering, picking up, I think, a few kind of math and physics classes as well, and then ended up, you know, getting to the point where my parents were just getting frustrated with me in courses all the time. I ended up just dropping the engineering altogether because I was almost done with commerce, finishing commerce and then doing an honours year in economics.
Was there any particular professor, or was there any lecture, or was there any kind of subject that really caught your interest? I know you did econometrics, I believe.
I had a lecturer by the name of Robert Dixon in the economics department, who I thought was just fabulous. Just one of the best teachers I've ever had, and got me kind of really, he taught me both quantitative methods, which is a statistics subject, as well as econometric modeling. Some of the more mathematical, technical subjects within economics. I really enjoyed studying under him. Yeah, I kind of like maths and programming, and I think both of those subjects were subjects that I found challenging and interesting, and that really kind of caught my interest and you know, made me realize I kind of wanted to head down a path of doing kind of more technical stuff.
I see. And you finished in 2006 here, and was it after 2006 you moved to The Economist, you had an internship with The Economist, is that correct? Or?
No, I took a job at the Australian Treasury.
Okay.
In Canberra. I took a job in the Australian Treasury. I was there for, about 8 months, and while I was there, you know, like most people there, I used to read The Economist magazine, and I saw at the bottom of one of the editions that they were advertising an essay competition where the winner got to, got a 3-month internship over there, and I thought, oh, that'll be kind of cool, and so I wrote an essay on subprime lending, and that ended up winning the internship, which was really good. So in early 2008, I got to go over to London for 3 months. And that was really, you know, at the Treasury, you know, at first at Melbourne Uni, I realized that I kind of like maths and statistics and programming. Then I found, you know, I kind of gravitated towards the more technical work at the Australian Treasury, doing mostly like the econometric modeling type work. And then when I was at The Economist, it was a really good opportunity because, you know, I spent 2.5 months writing about the global financial crisis, which I found kind of got a little bit tedious, but I basically pitched an article to my editor in the last couple of weeks on big data, and that was really formative for me because it kind of opened my eyes to a world beyond econometric modeling. You know, it was basically how the article was really focused on how companies are using techniques like the sort of econometric techniques that I learned at Melbourne Uni and that I applied at the Australian Treasury to kind of solving business problems. And you know, that really caught my attention, and that was actually where the idea for the company Kaggle that I founded came from.
I see. And when you pitched that article, was that kind of the start of companies using data and using econometrics to solve challenges? Was the start of it? Because it's a relatively new field, and was it back then in 2007, 2008, was that kind of the start of it, do you think?
It's certainly the start of it becoming more mainstream. At the time, they were calling it predictive analytics or predictive modelling. It certainly wasn't the very beginning. There were some fabulous case studies already. So, you know, I read, for instance, about Tesco, which was, you know, it's now the biggest third biggest retailer in the world. But in the early 1990s, they were a down-market British retailer. And they implemented this customer loyalty card with Dunnhumby, a mathematical consultancy. And that, you know, the data they collected through their customer loyalty card and the insights they gleaned from that data is commonly, you know, is commonly said to be the reason that Tesco rose from being a down-market British retailer to the third biggest in the world. You know, now there's, you may have seen the movie Moneyball, which is kind of a similar story about the Oakland A's, the baseball team. So there were actually some case studies out there of companies doing really interesting stuff with data and kind of demonstrating how it had totally transformed their businesses. So it wasn't the very beginning, but it was certainly before the time that it was really mainstream. And it, I mean, now you don't have to look very far before you kind of bump into people talking about big data, which is really the latest business craze at the moment. It wasn't a business craze, but it was being, you know, predictive modeling was being used by some advanced companies.
Just back to Kaggle. So you got the idea from Kaggle then when you were in the Economist. Can you tell me about that and kind of how you brought the idea to fruition?
What happened was I was basically, you know, one really nice thing about writing for The Economist is you can kind of call anybody up and you can say, hi, it's Anthony Goldblum. I'd like to speak to, you know, your chief information officer or your CEO or whatever. And literally everyone answers your calls. I didn't necessarily represent myself as an intern, but there was no reason to. So I got to interview lots and lots of senior business folk, and I'd ask them, you know, what are the... So where's predictive modelling on your list of priorities? And you hear from you know, quite a number of companies even back then that it was near the top of their list of priorities. But then you kind of speak to folk in their modelling team or lower down the organisation. It was really clear that these companies were struggling to do anything really serious as far as, you know, deriving value from their data. And it was frustrating for me because as someone who liked playing with mathematical models and statistics, I was like, oh, if only I could get access to that company's data, I'm sure I could do great things. But they're going to look at my background and they're going to say, well, you know, this guy's an economist. What does he know about stats or big data or predictive modeling? And so that was where the idea for Kaggle grew out of that frustration, which was, well, I know I can do great work. Somebody's going to look at anyone I approach. If I approach these people in another context, they would kind of, you know, tell me to get, they wouldn't give me the time of day. So I wanted to kind of create this meritocratic labor market where, you know, you as somebody who has a problem can post their problem, and anybody who thinks they've got a great solution to it can kind of post their solutions and have their solutions be objectively judged. So what Kaggle does is, you know, the company puts up a data set, people will build algorithms to make predictions on that data set, and then we'll backtest those algorithms against historical data to work out whose algorithms are the most accurate. So it's fully meritocratic. And so the best data scientists, you know, come out on top, and the next best comes second, and the next best comes third, et cetera, et cetera. So I really, you know, that was the problem I was trying to solve, give companies access to the best data scientists, and the best data scientists a way to sort of prove their mettle on companies' really valuable problems. I had seen something, there's an academic conference that runs competitions, data mining competitions, in order to decide who gets, you know, who gets to speak at the conference. They give a couple of conference slots over to the open to the winner of this academic data mining competition. So that was kind of something I saw as I was researching my article that I thought could be applied in the corporate world. And so that's where the idea came from. I went back to Australia, went back to the Treasury after the internship. There for probably actually a full another year. All the while, the idea was kind of sitting there in my head, and I was kind of refining it. but not really actively working on it. And then, you know, I was kind of restless. I moved across to the Reserve Bank in Sydney. I lasted there for 5 months. Pretty much as soon as I started at the Reserve Bank, I was sort of teaching myself to do web app programming so that I could build the site and, you know, starting to look for names and so forth. And, you know, after 5 months, I kind of had the courage to leave my job, work full-time on coding up the site and then launched it. I think I launched it in the beginning of 2010. I tackled a few kind of a combination of fun problems and problems from academia. The site got some really phenomenal results. You know, there was an HIV progression prediction problem, which was featured in Science magazine because it led to a big breakthrough that did really well on a tourism forecasting problem. Just a bunch of consistently this method of crowdsourcing predictive models would perform much better than really anyone had been able to do before. And so I knew I was onto something. Then started spending more time speaking to companies. I got Allstate as a customer. I got NASA as a customer. You know, some really, really big name customers. And, you know, before long, a huge, health HMO as a customer. The company was featured in the Wall Street Journal and The Economist and all sorts of places, and as a result of sort of some of the results we were getting. And before long, investors were sort of becoming interested and starting to approach us. And so in November of 2011, we came across closed a financing round with some really well-known Silicon Valley investors, and now the company is based in Silicon Valley or San Francisco, which is really exhilarating.
I think you've created an entirely new marketplace, an entirely new business model, a new company with this, because I don't think there was any other company like you in the world.
No, certainly not for predictive modeling. It's quite different and quite novel, and really quite effective as well. And it's also, you know, probably the most gratifying thing is we've now got 75,000 data scientists who compete on the site, and you know, they're from really all over the world, and we have them all ranked based on their competition performances, and we'll often invite, you know, folk in the top 10 to come out and spend a week with us in our office. And we have number one at the moment, an actuary from Singapore. Number two is a physicist from Oxford. Number three is a computational neuroscientist who teaches at Harvard Medical School. Like, we really have just a really interesting group of people. And, you know, some of them from academia, some of them from industry. But it's just got this great community feel about it. A lot of them have become friends. A lot of them, you know, felt very isolated and lonely as the only data scientist or the most capable data scientist in their job, in their workplace. Now they've kind of got an outlet for their creativity and their talents, and a community of sort of like-minded folk to compete against and interact with. And it's been really gratifying to the community aspect of Kaggle is just very interesting, and it's probably the most exciting bit.
And is it easy, Anthony, to keep that community together, to attract new data scientists, or to keep that user base kind of hanging around or interested in new problems?
Yeah, it's funny because it's surprisingly addictive. You'll compete in a competition and maybe you'll finish, you know, 19th, and you'll think, wow, you know, I really wonder what the guy who won did that I didn't do. And, you know, they might reveal a bit about their solution on their forums, and then you'll come back and you'll try the next competition. You'll get to 18th and you'll think, wow, I wonder what I have to do to get, you know, crack the top 10. It's actually very addictive. The other thing is that every time we put up a new problem in a new domain, we find it brings in a whole lot of new people. So we just put up a big problem for General Electric, which is, you know, very, very interesting aviation data that people wouldn't be able to get a hold of otherwise. So, you know, you put up that problem and it brings in a raft of new data scientists who are who had always wanted to play with an airline data set, for instance. So if I look at the growth of our user base, I mean, we've gone from zero to 75,000 in, say a bit over 2 years. And when we closed our fundraising round in November 2011, I think we were about 15,000 members, and now at 75. So you can kind of get a sense of how the community is just growing exponentially. And the interesting thing is that, you know, people always ask us how many data scientists do you think there are in the world? I would have said, you know, when we were a community of 3,000, I would have said, you know, probably not more than 20,000. Well, now we have a community of 75,000. So it seems like, it seems like we're becoming a place where, you know, both data scientists who are already trained play around, and also those who are interested in getting involved in data scientists sort of come and have a go. We have some simpler problems for novices to play with as well. And so we're doing a combination of bringing together very talented data scientists who are already out there and helping to train the next generation of data scientists.
The potential you've created through this company in using the internet to crowdsource a problem is hugely significant, and I think it hasn't been fully realized yet. I think it will, because it's opened up the opportunity to solve so many problems, not just for companies, but for society in general.
I certainly think that. I mean, you take the combination of a huge community of extremely capable people and who are very good at data science and just the potential of data science more generally, and really this company should be in a position to create a lot of value, both in the corporate world as well as in sort of scientific research.
What current projects are you involved with at Kaggle? You mentioned GE there. What additional ones are you involved in that you can talk to us about?
Yeah, I guess probably the biggest one at the moment is the one that launched most recently, which we're pretty excited about, is the problem for General Electric. Mm-hmm. We're working with, I think at the moment we've got about 10 Fortune 500 customers. It might even be 10 Fortune 100 customers. Companies like General Electric and Pfizer and Merck. I really like some of the work we do for pharmaceutical companies, helping them helping them with their drug discovery process. So it turns out you can actually use data science to help them find promising chemical compounds that might actually lead to great drug discoveries. For Pfizer, we're helping them to predict drug demand by geography, because they obviously don't want to run out of drugs in any specific location. You spend an enormous amount of money developing a drug. If there's demand for it, you want to make sure you can satisfy it. We do a lot of work for, I mentioned earlier the insurance company Allstate, yeah. Helping them predict, you know, the probability somebody's going to make a claim or crash their car, helping them predict the probability that a policy holder won't renew their policy, all that sort of stuff. We've got some really good ones. We're starting to do more work in the oil and energy industry. I can't really say much at the moment about what's upcoming there, but they're really challenging problems, really interesting data sets. Yeah, so quite a range of stuff.
Just lastly, last two questions is, you were recently on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list. Does this bring extra pressure? Or?
Certainly last year it was more of a shell shock than this year. last year, we just come over to America. We just raised a high-profile fundraising round from very well-known investors. It was kind of going from really just somebody who had been working out of my bedroom in Australia to being recognized as a Forbes 30 under 30 was a bit of a shock to the system. This year it was certainly a pleasant surprise, and it is really nice for the company. It helps bring us extra profile, and it was a pleasant surprise this year, as opposed to a total shock to the system, which is what it was last year.
Lastly, on advice, is there any advice you'd give to, say, students who are studying economics, or maybe they've an entrepreneurial spirit in them, or is there any advice you'd give them to these students or to entrepreneurs in general?
It's very easy, and I certainly fell into this trap. I think I always knew that I was sort of a restless person, but never really knew how to channel that restlessness. When you're in a system like you're studying economics, and then you go through to do honors in economics, you're kind of in a funnel that generally leads to going off and doing a PhD or going to work at the Productivity Commission or the Australian Treasury or the Reserve Bank. And it's just worth pausing and thinking a bit more broadly about what else is out there. If you are somebody who's restless and somebody who likes building things, I think it's not a low stress way to live, but it's certainly an extremely rewarding one, and I think it's an option that somebody with those characteristics would be well advised to consider.
What can be done to improve that, Anthony, in terms of the atmosphere, in terms of the startup atmosphere in Melbourne and in Australia? What actions could be taken?
Yeah, I think it's really challenging. It's a lot of cities and a lot of countries have made a very conscious effort to try and become the next Silicon Valley and really foster a startup scene. I mean, part of the reason it's challenging is I think it requires people to be surrounded by other successful startups. So, in Silicon Valley, you might have been an early employee at Google, and so you kind of understand how startups work, and then a couple of years at Google, and then you move on and you do your own tech startup, whereas there isn't surrounded by successful startups and great mentoring in Australia. And I think also the other thing is it's just not seen as an option. There's not a culture of entrepreneurship. I think that one thing that could make a big difference is certainly for people to be confronted with it as a career option. So, whether it be Melbourne Uni Career, the Career Service, or professors sort of making students aware that it's kind of an option. I think it's often, these are very formative times, and if there are folk around who can point students in this direction have it be an option, I think that could be really, really quite powerful. It's really tough, though. Good startup, it requires a whole ecosystem, and there's sort of not just one silver bullet or one answer. This is also a bit of a hackneyed comment, but one thing that's really interesting about Silicon Valley is it's very tolerant of failure.
Yeah.
So if you give it a go and you fail, you're not sort of persona non grata, but rather, it's almost a badge of honor to have tried and failed. I think culturally that's really important. It makes people much less scared of failing. So that's one really interesting aspect of the culture here. I think also Americans do a really nice job of celebrating success, and so people don't feel bad striving for success, whereas people sometimes say that Australia, there's this idea of kind of tall poppy syndrome where success is not celebrated, but rather it's something to be embarrassed of. And I think, I think there are nice aspects of that, but I think also from the perspective of a startup culture, the whole idea of dragging people down, I think Australians are probably just generally more humble than Americans, probably. But the corollary to that is that it means people potentially strive less because you can't own your success necessarily in the same way that you can in America.